This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on SyncBook Radio. Today, on episode number 11, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, synchro mystic and co-host of the podcast 42 Minutes, Will Morgan, as well as a second one-on-one dialogue with fellow co-host of 42 Minutes and author of Winter's Labyrinth, Douglas Bowles. Both guests this week, who are likely familiar names to many of you listening, provide valuable insights into the world of synchronicity. For those of you less aware, Douglas and Will are two of the founding fathers of the aesthetic intellectual movement best known as synchromysticism. Over the last 6 years, they have also done an amazing job helping to make the SyncBook a respectable platform that fosters offbeat artists and thinkers. While they spend most of their time nowadays asking other creative people about the work they do on 42 Minutes, I thought it was about time they had the spotlight put back on them for a short while. Both of them deserve tremendous credit for the work they do, and it was a pleasure for me, as a longtime fan, to pick their brains about their views on sync, life, and artistic expression. I think you'll notice more than a few interesting intersections between the two dialogues. So, thanks again to my guests this week, and thank you for listening.
It's weird because Jupiter for sure is like one of the biggest nodes ever. The 24, the 42 and everything. I mean, that's why we use it. And some people get a little bit confused because it seems so mundane. It's like that cliche, the mountain is the mountain, the flower is the flower, the mountain is not the mountain, the flower is not the flower. Or like Kotze's definition of sync, where it's talking about, you know, seeing mystical or esoteric symbolism in the mundane. In synchronicity, things are no longer mundane. There's like this hyper realism, hyper significance, hyper meaning to everything. And then you go so far down that path that it becomes mundane again. I mean, that's the secret of everything. When you understand that the mundane is esoteric, and that the esoteric is mundane, and that there's just a matter of degree.
The mundane is so magical because if you have the perspective that reality is much deeper, that must mean everyone is sleepwalking. So when you look at people carrying around mundane consciousness, or they see the world in a very myopic way, I mean, that is the ultimate illusion at work in these people's lives. It's like that mundacity is a reflection of the ultimate magic spell, which is amnesia in the human psyche or the human spirit on a mass scale. It's like the most magical thing you could behold, actually, is the fact that no one realizes that they're God or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And this goes back to the trend right now is to talk about Mad Men, of course.
Right, which I barely know anything about, unfortunately. Like, I'm pretty choice in the media I take in, and not that Mad Men's bad or anything like that, or I don't have a negative take on it, but at the same time, it's hard for me to get really invested in a new show or something. And a show, like anything else, is a ritual. It's a magic ritual in its way, depending on how you engage with it. And we all have our rituals or our habits, and sometimes hard to pick up a new one, even if you've experienced something similar, like you resonated with a show, but someone tells you, oh, this show is the shit. But it's like, well, again, it's just hard to pick up a new habit or a new ritual. And even bringing people around to sync or something, it's like the same thing. It's like people have these habits of mind about how the world is or should be or whatnot. And so when you try to introduce sync, it's like, it does not compute because it's not in their habits. So it's something that everyone sees, but you can kind of program yourself not to see these things, or you see them and you don't recognize any significance. Whether it's there or not, again, it's there for us, but it might not be there for someone else. That just opens up, again, what is reality to me more and more. Even if I question if synchronicity is, well, is it me being sane? Is it me being insane? Is it something just changing my nervous system? Is it actually something external to myself that's trying to communicate to me? It really opens up all these questions, but that's almost the point. It's not meant to have an answer. And maybe I would need Mad Men explored to me a little bit.
Well, it's advertisement. It's creating the value in the mundane. It's creating a status quo of product, and you need. And then that's the whole point. Like, you're talking about habits and stuff. It's almost like advertisement is an exploration of habits or understanding habits. Everybody gives Edward Bernays a bad rap, and there is plenty of reason to give Edward Bernays a bad rap. But you have to understand a lot of the things that he did. The best way to do that is not to explore like all of the, I mean, it's good to get informed through the documentaries and stuff like that that are online and the explorations of what Edward Bernays did, but you need to go further and actually look what he created. And some of the things that he created outside the typical, almost cliche example of the cigarettes is like bacon. The pork belly went to Edward Bernays and was like, we need to sell more bacon. So what did he do? He went to like a bunch of doctors, which was the whole like expert fallacy, and said, hey, tell everyone that eating bacon at breakfast is what you need to do. It's healthy. It's good. It's what the healthy people do. So then they do that, and bacon sales go through the roof. Now there's whole culture of bacon lovers, but bacon is almost synonymous with breakfast. He also did something interesting. Books, the people who were selling books, the publishers went to Edward Bernays and was like, hey, we need to sell more books. So what he did was he went to the people who were constructing houses, the architecture and stuff like that, and was like, hey, build the goddamn bookshelves into the structure of the house. Build these bookcases to where they have to fill them. So then they'll just buy books. It doesn't matter if they read all of the books or not. They'll just buy books to fill up the bookshelves. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. Nobody needed the books. I mean, most of the libraries at that time were for show. But if you place the need, you created the habit. And that's what Mad Men is. Mad Men is like this exploration into this individual who was trying to find need. Do you know what I mean? It's weird, man. Mad Men is weird because you go on a journey. It's a fool's journey. It's a freaking, it is a tarot in a way. There's divination to every media, because like Philip K. Dick, he said it, all media is information. I mean, that's its sole purpose. Or like what William S. Burroughs said, he was talking about individuals who see significance in things that happen during psychedelic experiences, where individuals will think that all words have to do with them. And he's like, you know, of course all the words that you're hearing have to do with you. I mean, you're the one who's hearing them. It's such a simple insight, but it's so very true. I mean, we interpret things according to who we are, and those who can make us feel good about the fact that we need deodorant, I mean, they serve a purpose. Maybe perhaps it's not all evil doing in its own right. It's just an understanding of the way things work.
And that's why I always have a sort of a love-hate with these sorts of characters, because they are ingenious and sort of the stuff they come up with is brilliant. It does reflect an intelligence and what have you. At the same time, is intelligence the only virtue? You know, I mean, is Edward Bernays smart enough to understand that he's actually participating in a sort of exploitative enterprise or an exploitative culture? Or I'm all for advertising and all for consumerism in a proper context, right? Like if it becomes a way of life, then it becomes destructive and it helps put a superficial gloss over all kinds of exploitation that's going on in a socioeconomic sense. And if it's a fixated part of life, well, then that it becomes about material acquisition and spiritual development starts kind of taking a, a backseat. Not that spiritual development is the answer, but also just, again, opening up different avenues in people's lives. If it's all about get as many books as you can, but don't read a fucking single one, it's basically propagating a culture of stupidity. I mean, Bernays was all into, you know, understanding the herd animal nature of people, and he was interested in herding us more, I think, than liberating us. So, well, I appreciate
intelligence. Yeah, I mean, it's confirmed. He thought everybody was stupid.
Sure. And he wasn't wrong, right? I mean, in a certain sense, I don't want to say.
Right.
As harsh as that is, I mean, there's a lot of sleepwalkers and a lot of, I mean, Robert Anton Wilson says this, George Gurdjieff said that, all kinds of folks who actually have experimented with brain change or in the brain changing industry like Bernays, it's like, yeah, we know how people work in an automatic unconscious kind of way. And some of us try to manipulate that to make a profit. And other people like Wilson were like, hey, I want to liberate you. Listen to me. You're running on autopilot 99% of your life. Wake the fuck up.
Well, you know that Hermes had like a dualistic personification of what he is. Most people understand him as like the youth wing-footed, wing-helmed, caduceus-wearing messenger of the gods, Quicksilver, symbol of Flash, symbol of Quicksilver in modern media where it's like quick, bam, 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 bam. The other one is like an old man or the hermit, I think is most people will commonly know him as. A hermit comes from Hermes. But the young one was usually seen with a coin pouch because it was a symbol of like his product being sold. Do you know what I mean? If Hermes stood for the communication and like the word and so forth, then the accumulation of knowledge to get one over on your fellow man. That's what the five senses tell us. Knowledge is basically the use of knowledge is to get one over for personal gain.
I mean, that's a way of interpreting it. I also see the hero's journey. So Joseph Campbell's talking about how basically in a lot of these myths, people go to the underworld, get a boon, bring it back. But then there's a responsibility to bring it to the community in a way that's like, hey, here's something new that we might be able to utilize that might have utility for our culture, for our way of life, or for our survival or something, you know? And the flip side of that is the tyrant, which is you get a boon, but then you sort of betray your mission to share it. I see so often with these things, it's like divine inspiration or whatever you want to call it. It's like Beethoven. We're just talking about that on the call, like music and these inspirational moments. They're meant to be shared with your fellow man and presented in a way I think that is, if the species fails, you fail. We rise and fall together as a species. It's like it's this cult of individualism. Synchronicity points to the importance of the individual, but I can't shake, again, if everything's connected, well, we have responsibility to each other too, right? So it's a wave particle situation. It's both things at the same time. So yeah, I mean, getting over on somebody, okay. But at the same time, there should be boundary conditions to freedom. If you're totally fucking up someone else's life to make yourself better, that's parasitism. I mean, that's not a co-beneficial way to survive. That's not a sustainable way, I think, to sustain any sort of enterprise. And if the human experiment is an enterprise, it's an experiment. It's like, how do we keep that going? And so there has to be a sharing complementing that, I think. But I get what you're saying.
Would Ayn Rand disagree with you?
Probably. I think Ayn Rand is a bit overrated. There's certain things I like. At first, I started liking this idea that one of my favorite quotes of hers was, if you want to find truth or something, it's like, look for the contradictions, iron out the contradictions, and that'll get you closer to the truth, right? And for a while, I thought that. But then in reading a bit more about, like, say, magic, you know, the whole aim to be 100% consistent in everything you do or your thinking process, I think, is, like, totally wrong. Because no one is completely consistent. Fundamentally, we're inconsistent creatures in so many ways. So even in our conscious lives, if we strive for it, we're never going to get there. Because if we are unconscious creatures most of the time, there's always going to be contradictions in the way you think. So, you know, here I am espousing, okay, we have to be responsible for each other. But it's like, I behave in contradictory ways all the time to that philosophy. So you have to be willing to flow with that and understand your own sort of weaknesses or sort of blind spots to your own contradictions. So I think it's only natural to accept our inconsistency. It's not saying it's like irrational, not to be irrational, but consistency and irrationality are two different things. Sometimes stuff doesn't have to make sense.
No, in fact, I agree with you completely, Bill Klaus. he made that comment about Robert Anton Wilson, you know, saying something to the effect that if you believe in something, you stop thinking about it. That's at the root of a lot of my philosophy. I'm almost always known as a conspiracy theorist, but everybody comes to me and they're always surprised when they're like, well, what do you believe? And I'm like, I don't believe shit. Like when they're talking about 9/11 and what happened with 9/11, what do you believe? So you don't believe that happened? No, that's the point. Don't believe shit. Just think about it. Think about what happened. Think about the consequences. Think about why it would happen. Who could do it? Most importantly, who could pull it off? That's what you need to think about. And that's the same thing. That's why I love Sync. Like I was way into UFOs for a long time there, but I quickly realized it doesn't matter how much you research, you're not going to be able to firmly say anything, and it's going to be a long time. If it ever changes, it's not going to be anytime soon. That's the thing with like UFOs. The whole UFO puzzle is this like rainbow that keeps getting further and further away from you. Sync doesn't pretend to have an end to the rainbow. Sync is the rainbow. Do you know what I mean? You're going to keep on chasing it because it's not a destination. It's a tool. It's a freaking like walking stick to keep moving, to keep learning. Like there's so much stuff out there for people to understand that they have to know they can't learn it all at once. It's got to be a journey. It's got to be a journey. It's got to be a path. It's got to be a pain. And pathology and pain are very similar. And moving, hiking, it's not pleasant. I mean, ask Crowley when he fucking climbed K2 if he had a good time.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's just like anybody who does that sort of thing doesn't do it because it feels great. They do it because the pain lets them know they're alive. That's the trick. That's the trick. To not focus on the destination, but to focus on the journey.
And I was just talking about this in the Hangout before we got on our call, and I was just riffing a bit on what role does synchronicity play, and of course it plays all kinds of roles, but I'm like, well, it's there to dislodge people from, I guess, a plateauing, or if you choose to pay attention to it, it'll introduce some weirdness or something for you to question, and then that could be the thing that you then use to kind of transition into all kinds of topics or learning or whatever, because, I mean, humans, by and large, with our ability to comprehend symbols and manipulate reality in all kinds of interesting ways. It's like we're the ultimate learning organism. I mean, that's what we're here for in so many ways. And to what end, I don't know. Maybe it is just to terraform the planet in random ways. And I don't know. But all I know is that we have this capacity that other creatures don't. It doesn't mean we can rape and pillage everything or have that right. But
are we even raping and pillaging? See, I mean, Alan Watts said something to the effect of like the planet, it peoples, like an apple tree apples, but earth peoples. And we have this delusion of like original sin, and that illusion makes us think that we're bad fruit.
Mm-hmm.
So what we need to understand is that whatever's happening, however we dislike, is exactly what's supposed to be happening.
But then the question is it all deterministic? We have no agency at all.
Okay. So I remember reading this one Kabbalistic book. It had this example where there's a mean, ugly person in the village. And then one day the boulder shakes loose and rolls down the mountain and smashes the house of the really evil, wicked dude. Was the rock the product of the evil dude, or the evil dude the product of the rock? And then there was also, I mean, we were talking on the call today. The conversation part that I was aware of was about Andras Jones playing out in the elements. That was a cool word because that kept coming up. But the elements and the actual elements participating in the show based on the meaning of the song and in the absence of randomness that creates as far as what we would call sync. So how do you feel about that?
I always come back to chaos theory. It's like, it's the best analogy I've ever found for how reality actually works. And we can imagine, okay, so let's take the Alan Watts idea that we're all fruit on a budding tree or something, and that like any sort of organism, there's going to be fruit that makes it and fruit that doesn't, this and that. And where we bud on the tree is sort of random. Okay, so let's just take it there where we're an organism. That organism has a particular shape and certain dynamics to it. At the same time, if you think of just geometry, the geometry of the tree, in chaos theory, it maps systems through turning them into sort of geometrical objects, mapping their patterns, and then turning that into a geometrical representation. So you map weather, and you're going to get this sort of infinity sign or owl eyes. It's called a Lorentz attractor. And within that attractor space, there's all sorts of novelty and what you could call free will if you're an individual within it. At the same time, when all the interacting parts add up, you get this sort of deterministic path. So it's like a track everything keeps running on, and some of the tracks are more complex depending on the dynamics of the system. But at the same time, so there's this global order, but within the global order, there's all sorts of free will choices and what have you going on. There is, in essence, a global determinism, but because you can never, it's always turtles on the backs of turtles if you're thinking about how the universe is. It's always a system within a system within a system. And so you can never say where it ends or begins, and you can never say that there's one ultimate shape to things and that everything has to follow this destiny. And at the same time, like, the elements within a system in chaos theory can help change the shape of that overall pattern. So we're not determined fully. So if we learn, like, all systems or all human organisms or learning systems, if we learn enough and learn to change our behavior or our the shape of our paths and so on, that we can reshape the attractor space that we work within. The language I'm using is sort of abstract, so I hope I'm communicating this well. But there's an overall pattern that we're working within, but we have free will choices within that pattern. And the pattern influences us, but if we all sort of take the time to learn and go with the flow, so to speak, we can follow synchronicity. So it's this sort of arrow on the path or some sort of benchmark or something to kind of lead you, or it's the rainbow, but it's leading you towards that kind of self-organizing destination, maybe.
Do you remember your conversation with Campbell?
Sure.
Okay, so now that was pretty impactful for me.
What I just talked about, we kind of touched on there, so I hope there was some resonance.
Well, yeah, of course, because you're talking about the holographic, or his, don't want to say definition, I want to say model. Okay, so what he says is basically his working model is this video game where everybody has their thing. Well, I mean, you've seen Wreck-It Ralph?
Wreck-It Ralph? No.
You need to do yourself a joyous thing and just watch a good movie. Just watch Wreck-It Ralph. What year were you born in?
85.
So you played plenty of video games.
Oh, of course.
And you've played multiple systems. You know how, like, you know the fucking land work of the territory, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I've been playing probably too many video games. And the thing is like, because of that interview you did with him, I couldn't help but get all metaphysical about it. Like, there's sinky shit that happens in games that are meaningful to me, I guess, that are, I guess you would call like a fucking, I guess you had to be there situation. However, today, specifically, I woke up this morning and I was just like, oh shit, you know, I did all my stuff. I'll play video games for a short amount of time. And I'm playing a certain game called Watch Dogs. The thing is about this game is what this game is about is hacking. Like, you have a cell phone, you can go throughout this game and you hack shit. You can hack street lights and then all of your experience points and add up to skills, and these skills make you better at what you're doing, so forth and so on. However, the interesting thing about this game is they have a multiple player game. And multiple player games are very interesting to me because they're Campbell's model that he was talking about, where I'm online and I'm interacting with another person's universe. Do you get what I'm saying? Like, they have a different set of rules, but we have different views of those outcomes. This creates glitches. And that's what the movie Wreck-It Ralph is about. One individual has, that's like their superpowers, the glitch, rewiring of the matrix or the rules or so forth or so on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a way, like, Neo is a glitch in the system. Well, I mean, when the story of Neo plays out, both the Oracle and the Architect are part of the same system. And then that's the whole point, right? Like, the system had a back door. But this is true. This isn't like, it's a cliche in the movie Wreck-It Ralph because it's an actual truity. It's an actual truth. It's something that we see. Everybody's seen glitches. No matter what system you played on when you were a kid, John, you saw some crazy shit where it wasn't operating like it was supposed to, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the Whitley Strieber or the Philip K. Dick or the whatever experience that we're having. Anyways, today, while I was playing this dude, this is the object of the game. You're a hacker. So instead of having like an alternate multiplayer realm, like this player is, or this realm is for your progression in the game, and this realm over here is for when you play with other people online. The game for the progressive thing is mixed with the multiplayer, so people can invade your game and they can sneak up on you and they can hack your shit, and then they can run off and hide while they're trying to hack your shit, and you have to go find them. It's fucked up. It pisses you off. Like, you're fucking doing your shit and somebody starts hacking you and you're like, you're a fucking asshole. I was in the middle of some shit. But doing it to people is really fun. And I got to tell you, like, emotionally, I'm very keen on my body. When I'm watching a movie or when I'm saying something and I feel like a bodily sensation, I'm like, okay, something just happened. Pay attention to what just happened. You know, try to categorize why you got that emotion. I get no emotion like this game. Like, I'm playing Watch Dogs, and as soon as you initiate the hack, like, you're hiding and they have to find you, my heart starts pounding and I'm like, oh fuck, my palms get sweaty and I can't do anything. I'm not doing anything in the game. I'm just having the controller in front of me so I don't touch it so nobody fucking finds where I'm at. You know what I mean?
Right. Like,
it's so weird. I'm not doing anything, but I'm having the most emotional reaction to this shit. It's like, it's not playing, it's making me nervous. Like, not playing, it's making me nervous. But the thing is, today, while I was playing, continuing my digression, while I was playing, I basically had to catch up with this fool. And this fool was like mid Grand Theft Auto. Like, the police were hounding him, the police were like all over him. But I had to follow him so I could hack him, so I could start hiding, so he could find me. And he was already, like, at a disadvantage. But what was so fucked up is while I was following him in my car, he was ahead of me, and behind him, there were cops chasing him. But the computer couldn't relay the information. Behind him, everywhere he didn't see, all I was seeing was complete chaos. Complete chaos. Like, cars were materializing behind me and to the side of me, and every which way there was like shit going on. Police cars were like slamming into cars and then they were disappearing. People were disappearing on the side of the road. There was just too much shit going on. And that really perplexed me for a second. Like, I had to think about that because that is so quantum mechanics.
Yeah, it goes to show you how even microphysical principles, which are said not to manifest themselves on a macroscopic level, at least in how consciousness is structured, I mean, for sure, you see that come through again and again.
Well, I mean, behind him, it was a wave. It was complete wave. Like, there was no certainality to his universe where the cops were. On his screen, he had no idea things were going nuts. But what I was seeing was a manufacturer of, like, the computer trying to generate possibilities. So even though it worked, it wasn't working. What I saw behind his viewpoint was just this mashup of what the computer could think of. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Sure.
And then that's, like, more important to me than, like, the overall game or even it being solidified as, like, what I see on my screen. And they're getting better. They're getting better at, like, generating characters and generating scenarios and physics and all of that shit. But there's still so many fucking glitches. And my working my working analysis as far as like a sync head is that there's all kinds of motherfucking glitches. Like there's all kinds of like tricks that the system has of making things conjoin so they work. But in all actuality, they don't fucking work. So when you're talking about like, you know, a fatalistic idea, that doesn't even make any sense to me because it's both. It's always both. It's not a destiny. There is free choice. Like, he could have been doing whatever he fucking wanted to, but behind him, like, the computer was just trying to deal with him. The computer was just trying to make it as fun for him as possible because the dude had no point. He was probably having the time of his life, but there was no fucking point to what he was doing. But the computer was just trying to keep up. And that's the thing. You can do whatever it is the fuck you want to. That's your free choice. But the computer, the system, the matrix is going to make sense out of it. It has to. There's no other choice.
There's a feedback between the two.
Right, because it has no purpose other than to do that.
That's why I never can completely jive with, like, the computer analogy for the universe is great, but computers themselves are not terribly creative things. Any creativity the computer could do came from the human agent that designed it. So to ever say that a computer has this creative potential, et cetera, it's like, yeah, well, okay.
Well, it's just consciousness. I mean, whatever people, whatever consciousness people will put in computers is what feeds back. It is a feedback loop. But that's like the all of existence is just a feedback loop.
Mm-hmm. But then the question is like, to what end? And all I can say is to like, to learn and grow. And so, and that's an organism, you know, as I see the universe sort of as an organism. If you really boil down the human body and you empathize with the cell, how could you ever comprehend the larger structure that you're a part of or the meaning of your existence if you were able to ponder it as a cell, which we kind of probably are in our own ways. We're sort of these, as far as the larger universe system goes, I mean, we might as well be single cell protozoa that have no consciousness as far as the larger system is concerned. We're these little things on a speck of dust. If you measured out the universe, we might as well be an electron. So that's why I always contend that if you go to the appropriate scale, all sorts of strange things can really like actually manifest on our quote unquote classical Newtonian level where everything is normal and stuff can never bleed through from say quantum mechanics. So this different sense of time, these different senses of reality, you know, what are these? Are these delusions or what are they? Well, no, it's just like if you go down to the microphysics level, it's like some electrons travel back in time. As far as the equations are telling us, and statistically overall, it adds up.
The whole point is to keep it going. There's that saying is like, why do men write poetry or what's the point of art or so forth? Because that's what fucking people do. Do you know what I mean? That's like it in a nutshell.
And it's a novelty producing enterprise. And I think that as humans, we're just always looking to transform ourselves. And it's funny, you just wrote an article on Transformers not that long ago. But that's really what we are, fundamentally. We're a transforming, polymorphous sort of organism that can change itself at will. It's just a matter of us changing our ideas about who we are and what we want to accomplish. It's really an incredible thing. And yeah, just kind of keeping that idea alive for people, even if it never becomes the predominant meme in society. And I'm not counting on it, because again, I don't know if we're in the Black Iron Prison or it's actually something that's meant to change. But either way, it's like keeping the candle lit in the dark. Seems to be the mission of all artists in all eras. There's always something deplorable about the context we find ourselves in. And it's the artist's kind of job or the philosopher's job to say, hey, we could be doing stuff differently, maybe better even. So it's an interesting concept of what evolutionary purpose art serves, if anything. Because again, usually the Darwinian interpretation is it's just to attract a mate to get fucked. That's it. But then that's totally excluding anything to do with consciousness, because in that model, obviously, it's all in your brain and nothing else. It has no meaning.
Well, sync is all about meaning, isn't it? I mean, sync is like the fucking home of meaning.
Yeah, absolutely. It gets people in touch with that, even if there's no rational explanation for it. People need to be more open to irrationality, because there is a lot of irrationality in the world. So I'm always a little apprehensive to say that. All these theocracies and other sorts of crazy modalities of organizing societies. So that's irrational. But at the same time, in our own personal lives, we can't be too rigid in how we see ourselves or see the world. you have to keep that suspension, which you mentioned earlier, to keep that tension open. Otherwise, if you settle on a belief system, then that belief system disappoints you. I mean, that's very crushing. I'd rather not hold anything too dear and then be able to adjust. And we jumped right into the conversation. And I didn't plan for this necessarily to be a strict question and answer traditional, because people that know each other, it's kind of weird to do that sometimes. But you come from a, would you call it a fundamentalist background? If you're comfortable talking about that and how you got to where you are, because that's interesting to me. I'd be interested to know kind of how you opened yourself up to a whole different way of perceiving things.
I understand exactly what you mean. I don't think that I come from a fundamentalist background. I think that I come from like a fundamentalist region for sure. I don't know. It's really complicated, and it's not at all what it seems. You're dealing with a lot of, I don't know, man. There's like this whole world history going on. Do you know what I mean? To understand where I am now, like I'm in Colorado, okay, and that's not nearly as, say, liberal as California. And so there's this whole like east or west thing, and then southern thing, and then like each region of the United States, and then like the whole back history of the Civil War and the Bible Belt's involved. And I don't understand what New York is, I don't think, because I've ever been there. I've never been there. But I do understand that the way that Colorado sees life is like almost the exact opposite of what, say, Alabama considers life. And so that realization at high school is probably a big influence. I can see both. My world's kind of confusing because, you know, I have so many friends back in Alabama, and that atmosphere is still a lot different. Right now in history, we're dealing with all this red eye stuff, and this all this Ferguson. We got Baltimore. We got all this racial tension going on that has seemingly been gone and non-existent for some 30, 40 years or some shit. But it's always been there. It was like the story of my life when I was a little kid. And I saw so much racism and so much like misunderstanding and so much literal belief in the Bible and this almost superstition. But I got very lucky because my mom and dad were hippies in this like hippie-less realm. And even the hippies in Alabama weren't like true hippies to what I've like discovered them by study. I don't know. It was just a very confusing and unusual place and mind frame that I grew up in. I understand that. And even now when I go back, I had this like little meditation when I was a kid where I would sit in my bed when I was like 7 years old, and I would clear my mind and I would think, I am the only one on the planet who is thinking this thought right now. Like, I am the only one who is me. It's like this meditation, you know what I mean? It's like this complete release. And so I found that difficult in older ages, say in Colorado, because it feels like everybody kind of thinks that. I'm so close to Boulder, it feels like some Bob Dylan is still there. some beat generation thought has changed that landscape up in Boulder forever. And when I go back to Alabama, that consciousness is not there. Like, the Bob Dylan feel is not there in Alabama like it is in Colorado, even at a younger age. There's like a difference in fucking thought. There's a difference in freedom. There's a difference in like understanding and acceptance. If you were growing up in Alabama, you wouldn't be so keen to pick up a book on Buddhism as if you were born in Paonia, Colorado. And that's true. Like, that's never left. I remember driving through parts of Colorado when I was in high school and having a certain feeling. There's a stretch between Glenwood Springs and Carbondale that is extremely lonely, where Snowmass Mountain is and Sunlight Ski Resort is. And you're driving through there and you're realizing to some degree, like, that mountain looks extremely big, but is in all actuality a long way away from me. And you feel really small. Do you know what I mean? And that feeling doesn't fucking encompass what Alabama is. Alabama is like, you know, rows of trees and you can't see where you're going. In Colorado, if you're driving around a corner, you can see 15, 20 minutes ahead of you. It's like below you and you can see this whole range of sky. It's a difference in thought. It's a difference in like energy. It's a difference in vibration.
It's like a psychic climate.
It is. And maybe it's only visual because you're not there on the mountain. You only visually see the mountain. You're in your car. Like, I have a friend who rides a motorcycle a lot. And he makes that point of saying when you're in the mountains and you're driving around the corner, you're there when you're on a motorcycle. There's a very minimal amount of things between you and that mountain. You can feel the air temperature and whatnot. You can't in a car, really. It's controlled. And it gives this illusion that that's only like on a screen. That's only on a TV screen. It's a false thing. The mountain's not really part of you.
Yeah. We have kind of disassociated ourselves from nature in a lot of ways. And no matter where you are in our culture, I mean, that seems to be the commonality, is we've all sort of accepted an alienation from nature, an abstraction from what it meant to, I guess, know something fundamental about what it means to be human. And so I think synchronicity is always, it really is that tether to nature that we can't hide from. We put ourselves in our cars, or we put ourselves in our suburban homes, or we bottle ourselves up in the same way we repress all kinds of things, and we do it in our physical space too, but ultimately reality can't be held back. And I guess it's the same kind of notion if you find yourself in nature and you're looking at something so vast and you realize, I'm so small, what does that mean?
Mm. Do you know who Joseph McMonagall is?
Is he a psychic?
Kind of psychic. He's a remote viewer.
Yeah, from SRI.
Yeah. So he wrote this book called Life of a Psychic Spy. It's like a memoir. It's like the true story of men who stare at goats or some shit. But anyways, he wrote this book and he was talking about, you know, this is like the base of the base. This is the military work with remote viewing. So it's like those who were in the freaking uniforms and stuff. It's like the Forrest Gump of remote viewing. So, or the Full Metal Jacket remote viewing. So they're doing these experiments, but I remember him explaining who was all in the unit, and they were all photograph analyzers. Their job before remote viewing was analyzing photographs. Mm. I've given a lot of thought. I mean, there's a couple of reasons why that could be, right? I mean, you could think of some, I'm sure, perhaps. I mean, because that's what they were doing. They were like staying in one room while thinking about what the photograph in the envelope is in the other room. Do you know what I mean? So they're like analyzing photographs. But there's something about that. There's something about the artificial experience of something actually happening, like staring at the mountain. And a mountain is just a mountain, and a mountain's no longer a mountain, and a mountain is just a mountain. Do you know what I mean? That's what that thought process is. You see the mountain, it's not that big of a deal. I'm going to go back to my iPod. Or you see the mountain, you're just like, what the fuck made that mountain? Where did that mountain come from? And then it goes back to the point where it's like, that's just a picture of a mountain. It's not like a real mountain. So I don't know. Did you see this thing that I sent you on Skype here?
Vince Maharis.
Yes, I'm interviewing this guy, and he did this wordplay where he said the first Wallace. And that struck me as interesting. Instead of saying V-A-L-L-E-S, you'd say V-I-A-L-I-S.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like a sync between the two meanings.
Yeah.
And the whole idea of Valis being some of this kind of like communication from a lost civilization warning us of like a doom or whatnot.
Well, I guess to jump into one of your other interests really quick, UFOs, if you're going to interpret the objective experience of the UFO, let's say these crafts are real and these things are out there, disassociating, of course, from these sorts of like interior endo experiences of alien contact. You know, we see these things in the sky. Sometimes we see them crash. What does that mean? What do you perceive them as? Are these things interdimensional? Are they future us? I've contemplated that a long time ago. And I wasn't the first, of course, that it's like, oh, well, if time is an illusion, maybe this is us in the future. And it's coming back to kind of warn us of something. Is that, I'm sure that's crossed your mind once or twice.
Of course, of course. And Radio Free Alamuth by Philip K. Dick, the first thing that ever happens to him before like the Valis experience, and it kind of gets overlooked because it's not like a necessary focal point of the story. But at the very beginning, he sees him at the edge of his bed, like as a ghost, to talk to him at the foot of his bed, but it's him. And it says something like, what does it say? Ich bin, or what, this is me, or something like that in German.
I am.
Right, like, right. Or I am you, or
something. Or my name is, you know, if you're introducing your name, you would say Ich bin John or something. So my name is, but it can also be interpreted as I am.
Something along those lines is, but that's what that scene relates, is this whole demonic idea. Like, and the demonic idea, or the daemon is explained through like individuals like Plato and is explored by Jung and stuff of that nature. Or more importantly, probably James Hillman. James Hillman really does this study on like the daemon being a symbol of the image of the human life as a whole. So there's birth and there's death, and what the holy guardian angel or the higher self would be the total image of the life at the end of it as the beginning. Like it's a total image. And so the individual life is communicated from the higher or the future self.
Yeah, it's like the McKenna premise, or it wasn't McKenna's, it was a guy named Deschardins or something like that, but this concept of an omega point. So we're getting pulled by an attractor from the future.
Right, that which would inspire individuals to write books about the Titanic before the Titanic sailed. And it's the same thing that McGonagall says when he would talk about the remote viewing would actually be not so much as like a peeking into space as it would be for time. Like he would realize that he already knew where the lost kid was before he actually remote viewed the lost kid. He was picking up the sensation of the kid that he found before he found it in this very Philip K. Dick or Looper type of way.
Yeah, and there are other instances in that research where they would remote view a location and they would come back. I mean, their success rates were unusually high. The more experienced remote viewers like McGonagall, who was just really, really impressive. If you look at their body of work or what's available, which is actually quite a bit nowadays. But anyway, there were instances where the remote viewers, including someone like McGonagall, would come back with a description of a place that was like, it didn't seem to match up and they were a little confused by it. But every once in a while, they would double check the details of a location and see what it used to be or something. So once they went to a pool or something, or like a recreational pool, and they're like, okay, remote view us now. And he came back and he drew all these sorts of like tanks and other sorts of accoutrement that wasn't at the pool. So they're like, well, that was a miss. Oh, well. But then later on, it was revealed that that place actually was like a water treatment center. It had all these tanks there, blah, blah, blah. So basically, he seemed to be looking in a different time. So he was viewing the place, but seeing it in a different time. So there almost seemed to be like, you mentioned, different places have these different psychic climates to them. In this sense, the past gets imprinted on an area and it's invisible to us, or it's coexistent and we just don't see it.
Or think of it like this, like perhaps he was remote view, like say if you take a picture of a water treatment plant in the year 2008 that was in existence in 1998, but you remote viewed it and you viewed the exact photograph that was taken in 2008 that you saw. Right. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't really like you actually remote viewing the territory. It was you remote viewing your understanding of the photograph that you saw later.
Isn't that crazy all the ways you can actually conceive of these situations when you think hard about it? Like, it seems so obvious, right? Like, oh, obviously he's seen two things at a different time, but just as easily, it's just as logical if we're talking about psychic powers and shit. Yeah, he was just seeing himself draw the wrong thing.
Or he was just gaining the memory of it that he never forgot. Like there's this like whole thing of individuals, especially in media, like actors who do this cloning idea of being in two places at one time are also usually seen being in movies where there's time travel involved. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So being in two places at one time is the exact thing as time travel. In specific, like Jake Gyllenhaal, there's this whole idea of, I mean, there's the Donnie Darko side, there's the Prince of Persia side. There's this new movie, I think it's called Enemy or something, where he hates himself and there's two of him. There's like a doppelganger effect. But there's also mm-hmm. like the Donnie Darko where he has the thing coming out of his chest. And if you remember the storyline of that, where it goes to where he's going, so it's going to the destination. And so he'll see the little blob come out and go to the gun or go to the beer. And then that individual get up and go get a beer or go get a gun, whatever the intent is. So that is translated into the movie Source Code, where Jake Gyllenhaal is continually riding this train over and over and over and over again. Each train has a different outcome. But the whole thing revolves around this symbol of the train, which is the exact same thing as the bubble coming out of the chest of Donnie Darko. It's this goes to, it has a destination. See, the thing about a train is when you get on a train, you're either going to Albuquerque or you're going to Albuquerque. It doesn't have a different destination. Do you know what I mean? It has a set where it's going.
And what's interesting with Donnie Darko is something that struck me, at least in my reading of sort of fringy science stuff and new sorts of research that's going on about the heart and what it's capable of, or does the heart cognize as part of the nervous system? Does it actually like influence the brain instead of, we conceive of the brain as being the center for everything, but in fact, we're finding, of course, that's a big part of it, but the heart and other parts of the body have all sorts of intelligences to them. And I know you're really into Wilhelm Reich, or maybe you're not really into him, but you've studied him enough and have brought him up and been enthusiastic about it. And I think you've talked about how, you know, you felt things stored up in your own body and releasing them through sorts of like contemplating it in a Reichian sense, that you have these memories imprinted in your own body. And I guess, yeah, what drew you to Reich, and what have you drawn from his work, and like, what is most important to you? Because I got into Reich, I'm not heavily into him, but I know I was introduced to him not from the psychology angle, or not even from the bodywork angle, but he did orgone energy and did these orgone accumulators, and that's big in the free energy community.
Well, I entered Reich through synchronicity. So there's like the reverse angle of that. It's interesting because I don't pretend to be an expert on Reich or have anything to give people to Reich. I'm not going to argue about Reich, in other words. I can just tell you what Reich gave me. And something that I'm into right now is bodily sensation. There's a whole bunch of that he's written on that. Are you familiar with this, where he says, like, we interpret orgone passing through the body through sensation?
Rudimentarily, I have a basic understanding.
Well, he basically came up with the idea of orgone based on Freud's definition of the libido, or his original definition of the libido, which he later changed, that had to do with something of like the orgasm is like an electric shock that can be felt over the skin of the body, and then that's an actual thing.
Right, and he merged that with the idea of the vital force, or this guy named Henry Bergson was maybe one of the first ones to espouse it, which is of the vitalist philosophical movement in the scientific world, that how do we define life? Because it's always this mystery, where how does dead matter add up to life when, you know, you see arrangements of dead matter everywhere, but not everything's alive. So what does that mean? So Reich threw his hat into the ring in that sense. It's like, well, it's orgone. And not only does it explain life, but it explains all this other sorts of, sensational things going on in the body and so on.
Well, I hate to be redundant, but it goes back to another like Zen Koan type of thing, where it's like, I think it's Confucius is walking with Lao Tzu, and Confucius is, they go over a bridge and the koi down below are swimming this way and that way in a pattern. And Lao Tzu says something like, oh, look how the fish take pleasure in moving as a school. And later on, they see a flock of birds, and Lao Tzu says, look how the birds take pleasure in flocking and all together in the right and to the left. And Confucius gets a little bit put off by what Lao Tzu is saying. He's like, you know, how do you know what the birds and the fish feel? And Lao Tzu says something to the effect of, how do you know what I know? Like, how do you know that I don't know what the fish, like they take pleasure. The whole thing is they take pleasure. Fish take pleasure in moving together as a school, and birds take pleasure in moving together in a flock, and birds take pleasure in migrating from this place to that place every year, and dogs take pleasure when their owner is on their way home. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, there's bodily sensations that we understand that, because science is so mechanistic, has turned us off to, or even our parents turned us off to. One of Reich's main things is talking about how the parents suppress natural behavior. So like when the child is really emotional and is upset, starts crying and starts kicking and screaming, then the mom and the dad say, stop screaming, stop crying. That's the worst thing you could do, is scream and cry right now. To act out, to express yourself is the wrong emotion. And so we tense up our emotions, or tense up our muscles whenever we feel those same emotions, because we've been programmed to do that as a small kid. And so, I mean, that's like very important. so Wilhelm Reich came up a couple of times, and like you can, the weird thing is you can like see it in my work, and I'm talking about Reich and stuff in my sync videos and stuff before Reich's actually there. And Reich was actually in my life before I was a fucking aware of my life or aware of its presence in my life. So in some way that it has fucking been there the whole time, but not been there the whole time in this very demonic way. Anyways, so what happened was, long story short, I started meditating when I was like 20, started having these physical sensations. I started seeing these visual things on the roof, and I'm like, okay, well, this is normal for meditation, so forth and so on. But through sync, I have found a group of individuals who were like into it. You know, they were seeing the same things. We could describe it. Some people called it like the wormhole. Some people called it black holes. Some people called it pinpricks. But it's the little spinny, whirly dinghies that you get in your vision occasionally. Some people get it when they're in the shower. Some people get it here and there. Have you ever experienced this?
Not so much, but I've definitely read about, like, in Castaneda and Don Juan books, that's definitely hinted at as a transitionary phenomenon that occurs in your visual field as you're going through some sort of, you know, shamanic awakening or something, whatever that even means, right? I think that's a spectrum as far as that goes, but it's a hint that something's going on.
So Patrick Harper, English individual who wrote this book called Daemonic Reality, A Field Guide to the Other World. We got him on the show on 42 Minutes. It's a great show. It's a great book. And I was doing a lot of research, so I was going and listening to a lot of interviews that he had done with other people. There's this great podcast called Where Does the Road Go, I think is what it's called. They share a lot of our same individuals that we interview. They do as well. Have you listened to this show before?
No.
No, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. You'd probably like it. But anyways, they interviewed Patrick Harper, and then like the week before they interviewed Patrick Harper, when I was downloading that, they interviewed this guy named Peter Robbins. Peter Robbins is this UFO guy, but he's actually done a lot of work with Oregon and had Reichian therapy. And he was mentioning Reichian therapy, and he, like, sleight of hand mentioned these pinpricks, these whirly dinghies, spinning waves, he called them.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was like my second wave into Reich, where I was like, okay, that explains the visuals that I have. So it's got to do with Oregon. I need to actually read Wilhelm Reich instead of just reading Wikipedia, you know? So I called my mom. I was like, hey, mom, you know, I told you about those pinprick black worm things that I see. Well, it turns out they're Oregon. And she's like, oh, you need to talk to your father. So I talked to my dad. I was like, hey, Dad, what do you know about Oregon? He was like, my dad, once again, Alabama. He was a geologist, grew up in Alabama, went to Auburn University where I met my mom, graduated as a geologist, a real kind of hippie, real conspiratorial minded, didn't pay his taxes for a while. So that's where he is now. But I think he likes sync, but he's not the sync mind. He's more of a scientific mind. My mom was more of the sync mind. My mom taught me that everything happens in threes, and that's how I kind of view sync videos. Like, if I watch a lot of actors, I don't really consider it to have a pattern until it's like three. If there's three movies with this one topic, then you got a pattern.
Real quick, not to interrupt you, but there's a little mantra in poker circles that the third time someone does something in close succession, that's when you should either like call them or take extreme notice of the situation. It's that law of threes.
Right. Of course, two is a coincidence. Three is a pattern.
Right.
So anyways, my mom told me about my dad. My dad was like, well, you know, he never talks about synchronicities. He was like, well, I was walking to this bookstore and I found this book called The Oregon and Me. And then it was this crazy book written by this actor named Orson Bean. And then there's another, you know, book that he gave me while I was there. He just pulled it off of the bookcase and he was like, you know, this book right here I had, and it's gotten eaten by these beetles. Like, the total cover of it was torn to shreds. He's like, I found it in a used bookstore. I bought it. I only got through the first or second chapter. It got eaten up by these bugs, but I didn't throw it away because the bugs only got to chapter one. It's like the bugs stopped when the book stopped. So my dad didn't throw the book away, and the book ended up in my hands. I've read it all the way through now. I think it's like Wilhelm Reich superimposition or whatever. So it explains so much to me because it was like all these sinky, all the great books in my life are through sink. Bottom line. Rupert Sheldrake, Mothman Prophecies, Whitley Strieber, Philip K. Dick, all introduced through sink. There's this one book by Richard Bachman, not Bachman. Richard Bach wrote this book called Adventures of the Reluctant Messiah. Illusions was what it was called. Illusions. Have you ever read this book? Do you know who Richard Bach is?
Negative.
He actually has some kin to Joseph McMonagall because he also was in the whole program of remote viewing. And he wrote this. He wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Oh, shit. Yeah, there's a book called Mind Reach that catalogs all the SRI research, and he did the preface to it.
Yes, that's probably – okay, so he wrote this book called Illusions, Adventure of the Reluctant Messiah, where it's this guy befriends a messiah-like character, and through this messiah, he's taught to do all these miracles, so forth and so on. But all the miracles are like SRI research-type miracles stuff. But anyways, he has these occurrences in this book where – first off, I mean, it's basically like of attraction. Think about this and these symbols will appear is what happens in the book. But the book actually was dropped in my lap like 3 or 4 times before I actually read it.
That happens to me a lot. I have to get beat over the head with certain things. The universe keeps throwing them at you and you keep ignoring them.
Right. That book was huge for me in that aspect. And so was like Wilhelm Reich and all of these other ones. Now I know that Wilhelm Reich is a big part of my life because it's been there the whole time. Like my dad read this book, which is basically one of the therapies in Wilhelm Reich is giving these really hard massages.
Alan was just talking about this last Always Record. He mentioned he went to a masseuse and similar experience where he didn't expect it, but all of a sudden she started really digging into his elbow or his shoulder, and it just released all these emotions, and it was really unexpected.
Right. Well, that's all Reich. Reich does like these where fucking you rub somebody so hard that they start crying.
Yeah.
And it's the crying that they're told is, and it's the same thing through Scientology. You know, like Scientology, you put your hands on these like two little things and they give emotional.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's good. Like that many people wouldn't be into Scientology if there wasn't some truth to it. Do you know what I mean?
It's true to the extent that it, I mean, Scientology has all kinds of problems with it. I don't think we have time to get into it, but yeah.
Right. It's the church and the hierarchy that has problems. It's not the basic gist of what's capable through, you know, biofeedback.
Right. Exactly.
No, I mean, that's just it. Basically, it's like being aware of what your body's doing, what your body's telling you.
Yeah. David Bohm, one of my touchstones. Again, a very abstract term, but he called it proto-preception of the body. We kind of have this with thought already in a lot of ways, like our reflexes and stuff. Our body just does them. We don't think about them. We just have a sort of, somehow our mind comprehends these things, but we haven't yet come around to that notion in our thinking process. So our thinking process is still very haphazard. It's almost like we're just learning to walk with these more sophisticated tools of the mind, whereas like, you know, we've mastered all our kind of animalistic instinctual kind of stuff, but now we were graduating to this sort of abstract level and we're still kind of tripping all over ourselves.
All right, I gotta switch gears, man.
Yeah.
What about this Mars shit, dude? What does this look like on Mars?
Oh, it's totally a UFO. Am I right?
No, but I mean, what does that mean about the history of Mars? Seriously, looking at this shit on Mars, I'll tell you what this looks like. It looks like whatever was between Jupiter and Mars blew the fuck up.
Oh, that's a, I don't know if it's between Mars and Jupiter, but it's called catastrophe cosmology, basically, where there's this idea of exploding planets. And it's got a tradition back to the early 20th century, but it was developed mostly by this guy Velikovsky, and he has other sorts of adherents nowadays, but they're definitely in the minority of the scientific community. And this idea of exploding planets and evidence for it in either neighboring astral bodies or...
like the craters on the moon and the craters on Mars would be like a product of that.
Sure. I mean, everyone has different theories about what's evidence of what, but there's certain core aspects of that theory that they're huge anomalies in the standard Big Bang cosmology. And they're like, well, it's explained through the exploding planet cosmology. But then the Big Bang adherents could come back and be like, well, this isn't explained through exploding planets and blah, 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 and back and forth forever and ever. And probably the truth is, honestly, it's like somewhere in between. Like everything else, there's always a compromise between these kind of extremist theories that we probably might have both things going on at once.
But, I mean, it looks like slosh. It looks like slosh was slung on Mars. Like there was water. Like it looks like there was water slung on Mars, and like Mars's atmosphere was blown off.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt there's water on Mars, and there still is in the form of permafrost. Strangely enough, that's so weird that it's like, yeah, there's an ice layer on Mars. It's the red dusty planet, and there's fucking ice on it. It's like, what?
Well, I mean, then to that extent, all of the fiction that we have about the Earth being seeded would have some kind of like unconscious truth, or is that just like propaganda?
No, I think that could make a certain amount of sense. Or if we see the solar system or the universe as a giant organism, these sorts of bodies, these neighboring bodies that are more local in our solar system, are kind of pollinating each other and fertilizing each other that way. So in that sense, you have these galactic catastrophes or solar system events, and it seems like they're just kind of random rocks blowing up, but in fact, they're actually seeding each other with life and creating these highly complex ecosystems where obviously something kind of dies, like Mars, or it terraforms itself for the sake of another organism. You know, it's the ultimate thermodynamic energy. It's got to be conserved. So one thing dies, another thing lives. And we just might be the most recent incarnation of that, you know? And so maybe when the Earth dies, whether we blow it up or it just reaches a natural end, we might pollinate something else. And then the question is, does all the information we've stored and like learn all the things we've supposedly learned, does that stay? And then when we pollinate the next planet, does that help inform the next planet and their evolution? And do they get to our point even faster? And then they can evolve. These are highly speculative, but if, again, you mentioned Rupert Sheldrake. So if we take the idea of morphic resonance seriously in a morphic field, it's like, here's this memory field that species learn from. And so anything put into it, if enough emphasis and time goes by, that's going to get imprinted into the field, and other like species, your own species will be able to tap into it in the future. So every little thing you do, I guess, if I have to believe something, I guess, why not that? Because it gives more power to your everyday actions and your everyday thoughts. It's like, yeah, I'm sort of contributing to this huge data stream, a timeless Akashic field almost, you know, that everyone will benefit or not benefit from sometime in the future. So every little thing you do has ramifications.
Do this in the memory of me. Is this familiar to you?
I've heard that.
Amnesis. It's like a thing in the Eucharist where one remembers.
I remember that from... I grew up Irish Catholic, and I've been to church a lot. And yeah, whenever they're holding up the Eucharist, they say, you know, this is my body and blood. Take this, eat it, drink it, do this in memory of me. It always ends, do this in memory of me. And then the bell chimes. That's, that's what I remember it from, but I don't remember exactly what part of the scripture or something. But
I just think about this whole, it's like Total Recall on Mars. Do you know what I mean?
Yep, and recall is just memory, and we're talking about a memory field, and that all adds up. I guess the last thing I want to touch on is just like your work with 42 Minutes, so you're still doing that, and every week you seem to put out a show, and so the diligence you guys adhere to, I'm always impressed by, and you're always bringing on interesting people, people from Inside Sync, Outside Sync. And so what do you still get out of that 180 some odd shows in, and besides 42 Minutes... I know you are at least flirting with the idea of a book or some sort of project like that. So can you give us any details on that too?
Well, as far as 42 Minutes goes, the greatest thing about it is that we're not like trying to focus on any one thing. The belief that Sync is shared everywhere and being open to anything and any interpretation anybody says about anything has given us the right to dive into anything. So like sometimes we do these poetry months where we're reading a lot of poetry. Sometimes we're doing a lot of music stuff, focusing and opening yourself up to whatever anybody else is doing, and to the point where you can be excited about their work has given me such an insight on how to just understand the depth of like human creativity. There's no like right answer to anything. And so once you're enthusiastic about everything, then there's some kind of level of joy. Do you relate to that?
Oh, totally. I like to think that Pentimental has a certain focus, or I try to keep it thematic, but at the same time, it's like I have a lot of interest myself and I want to talk to a lot of different people, and all these things connect in some way. You know, it's like everything comes from the human mind, so everything's going to tie together somehow if you really look at it in the Gestalt sense of things.
Right. It's all about Gestalt for sure. Now, as far as the story goes, now the story is something I've talked about before. It's something that has developed inside my brain, and it's tried to come out quite a few times and has never been successful. And I think that it took me understanding, or at least becoming familiar with the idea of sync, to understand that anything you create is birthed and not necessarily like planned. So it's like something that I have to whittle away until it's what it is. And it's not, I don't know. It's the things are hard for me because they necessarily never have like a goal. I'm like on constant freestyle. So there's that. However, Sync has told me that once you see the pattern, exploit the fuck out of it. The basic gist of the story, well, the understanding I have is that you do your work in secret and you just show people the result. So
you're gonna play close to the vest a little bit.
Oh, play very close to the vest, just because it's for whoever reads its imagination to elaborate on. It has little to do with me when in the long run.
Do you have a time frame for it? When do you want to have it done by?
Oh, fucking when I die.
So we might be waiting a while.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
I'm always working. I mean, I think people need, I don't think people understand like the work that I've actually done. I mean, if people are interested in my work, they can go back and find the Merriman podcast that I think is on podomatic.com. But you should be able to Google Merriman podcast and it come up. There was a lot of work in that. Plus, like all the 42 minutes, I mean, that goes on forever. I can't even remember how many times I've made an ass on myself. You know, I've made an ass of myself so many times on radio, it's pathetic. So there's plenty of that to enjoy. But there's also the unfoldment of A Few Shots to Shaman was a very personal journey I had in learning sync. The journey that I had in the sinkhole was long, and there's been a lot of stir in the sinkhole lately. Like, we're probably getting more page likes on the sinkhole than we've had when it was actually running. That's me. I mean, there's a lot of art going on. There's a lot of stuff that I do for Radio 8 Ball. There's a lot of future projects for Radio 8 Ball. There's a lot of actors that I just sit back and watch actors all the time, man. There's been so many that I haven't even done work on where it's just like I'm watching these movies just to see these concepts. Hey, let me tell you real quick about this concept I had about aliens, man. And this will be the last thing that we talk about, okay? Okay, so I'm sitting here reading Whitley Strieber, right? And Whitley Strieber happens on Christmas 1985, I think. So that night, I think it's the night after Christmas, but that night is when he has his experience where he actually remembers, right?
That where he sees the alien in his living room.
Right, where he sees the alien walk around. That's like the first time he remembers something, and then he goes back and remembers more, and other stuff happens. But it's the 1985 thing. So I'm thinking about this whole 1985 thing. I'm reading this Whitley Strieber. I go over to my friend's house and he's watching this movie called Ted. You ever seen this movie?
Is that the one with Mark Wahlberg and the bear?
The teddy bear. Yeah, the teddy bear wakes up and talks to him on 1985 Christmas.
Okay.
He makes a wish. He wakes up the next morning and the bear that he opens for Christmas Eve starts talking to him, becomes his best friend. And so I immediately associate the bear with the gray aliens just because of those two things happened to me on the same day. You see what I'm saying? They both happened on Christmas, and it's like, okay, so the bear, the alien, right? So then my friend makes this comment. We see this thing where it's like all these, like, it's showing movie posters of similar movies that happened on the same year, like Armageddon and Deep Impact. There's been like rolls of these movies, the same movies come out in the same year. So, and then my friend, we're talking about more of those that we can think of other than the ones that are on the website. And he says, oh, like Ted and Paul. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? He's like, that movie Ted and that movie Paul, where one's a gray alien, one's a teddy bear. They came out in the same year and they're similar topics. I was like, why do you think they have similar topics? He's like, I don't know, it just makes sense, right? So maybe unconsciously he got it on that level. So I watched Ted, and then I watched Paul. And when I'm watching Paul, this gray alien crashes, and then he brings the girl. There's a little girl that he crashes, and he kills her dog, and the dog's named Paul, and he's named after the dog. There's this whole alien Hermes thing, right? And then he comes back to the girl because the whole old lady's like this tinfoil kook. She says that there's aliens, nobody believes her, and he comes back and he's like, sorry, I'm a real alien. Nobody believed you, but it's true. And he reaches in his back pocket and he gives her her teddy bear. And then I found out like these there's teddy bear. And then somebody made this comment that the whole Devil's Tower that's in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, that's at the end of Paul too. It's like a throwback to all the other sci-fis ever came before it. But the legend goes that my mom goes to Wyoming. She visits the tower and she writes me back. She's like, hey, do you know that the legend is that this was made by a giant bear? She's like, this witch is going after these children and she starts turning into a bear to attack the children. And then the heaven lifts them up so that the children are above the earth so the bear can't get into them. And the claws down the side of the mountain are the bear claws from it trying to climb up. So this is bear, alien, bear, alien, bear, alien, bear, alien. My kids are watching this movie called Big or Brother Bear. I'm like, who's the voice of the bear? I'm always paying attention to voices, and I'm always like keying in. I'm like, oh, that's Matt Damon. Oh, that's Kevin Spacey. Blah, 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 blah. So I'm like, who's the damn bear? I recognize it. Don't know who it is. Look it up. It's Joaquin Phoenix. This whole Jesus bear thing. And then I immediately associate him to the alien movie of Synchronicities, right? So long story short, this is how sync works. Sync is always a long story. So it's just this bear thing. I couldn't figure out what bear, alien, synchronicity, what do bears have to do with aliens? And I realized it's not the bear, it's the teddy bear. And the reason it's the teddy bear is because a teddy bear is like a security blanket. It's not really there. To get it, teddy bear has no life on its own. It is only the life that we install in it. And we carry the teddy bear around with us everywhere we go. No matter what development stage humankind is in, it always needs this teddy bear to think that it's not alone. But it's not true. The teddy bear doesn't exist. The aliens don't exist. The aliens are just a manufacturer of what we have injected in physical reality, when physical reality has no existence of its own.
So even if we see craft, right, and that's like a group hallucination or something akin to that,
it doesn't even matter. It doesn't even matter if it's a real craft, because the personification we put on the craft, all the hope, all the fear, are nothing more than what we have injected into it.
Right.
So it's not the insight. Sync works on insight. Sync is all about epiphanies. You get a thread until you get the insight, and then the sync will go away. All right, man. We got to call it quits for sure.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the Sync Book Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other Sync Book Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.